Welcome everyone to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 344. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me as always are Guillaume Bayette.
Bonjour.
And John Lindemann.
The one and only.
Mm-hmm. James is off to see some nerdy band tonight. Sounds familiar. Actually, James hardly ever misses the podcast. He is certainly entitled. It's our summer of difficult scheduling continues, and it's not over yet, I promise you. But, we do have a fourth chair tonight with our good friend, Mr. Michael TYP Cole.
I'm back.
Yeah, we were just commenting. It seems like it's been a while since you've been on the show, Mike.
Yeah, unless you count E3.
Well, I do, but it's, okay. Yeah, it's definitely been a while since we had you like on a full episode.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's good to be back, guys.
Yes, you are one of our favorite substitutes for sure.
I'm playing T.
We're going to do a little bit of emails later on. In fact, I don't know, depending on how long they take, I kind of felt like maybe we'll do a lot of them. Kind of feel like maybe without James here, we can get through more of them than we normally do.
Yeah, we'll have less opinions.
Mm-hmm. No, you're wrong, John.
No, you're wrong, TYP.
Less yelling into the microphone so that the editor has to, like, de-amplify entire sections of his audio.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Which, there on last week's show, Guillaume, I could actually hear where you did that.
Oh, yeah, I did not try to make it subtle.
No. And having done it many times myself, I feel your pain. All right, so anyway, we're going to kick off with new business as usual. There are some interesting games to talk about this week, and John is going to go first.
All right, I picked up Shantae on 3DS Virtual Console for Game Boy Color. This continues my tour of all the Game Boy Color games that I've always heard about but never got a chance to play because I only had my Game Boy Color for like a cup of coffee.
Yeah, that's what Virtual Console is good for.
Yeah, I was actually really happy it came out. I was kind of looking forward to it. It's one of those games that was sort of hyped up, but I never had a chance to ever play it, really, so I was completely fresh to the experience. And it's interesting. It's kind of frustrating, definitely at the
yes,
start.
Yes, I agree.
It's, I've barely really scratched the surface in it. I made it through the first area. I made it to Scuttletown, I guess. Oh, I guess I'm at Scuttletown is where I am. It's where you first come in and you first have a chance to go to the save room and that kind of stuff. So I'm right at the very beginning.
So you're saying you've only gotten to like the very beginning of the game?
Pretty much, yeah. Yep. Yeah, but I mean, I just bought it, I think last night. The night before.
Well, I would do the same thing, John, because I knew we were going to discuss this. So have you gotten to like the first dungeon yet, or have you like just explored around?
Are there dungeons?
Well, yeah, I think so. Yeah,
I'm at the second town, so I've also downloaded this because I was super curious.
Yeah,
I'm at the second town, so I've played it for like maybe 90 minutes total, probably. Mm-hmm. Which is
I made it further than you guys. I didn't think I'd even have time to play this game before the show.
Okay, well, I was traveling the whole weekend, and I was actually the entire last week I was traveling. But yeah, I have not found a dungeon yet. I think I'm on the way to the first dungeon because I talked to a guy who's supposed to open it for me. Because
yep.
I passed the entrance, but I couldn't actually do anything there. And then I went on to the next town, and then I met a guy there who's supposed to help me. But man, this game is like, there's this very old school Zelda feeling of like, what the hell do I do next?
Yeah. Well, I can tell you, just coming out of the Scuttletown gates, I don't really know where to go. Both places I go, whether I go left or go right, I generally get my ass whipped, especially if I go left and I'm fighting these Hydra sort of women that shoot at you. And the thing is, what I'm just seeing just from, my initial impressions of the game is that the pacing is a little bit off because I feel like your character can jump so high and move so quickly, but a lot of the enemies, the way they attack you sort of drag you down and they force you to go slowly. And also a lot of the enemies, it can be pretty cheap because especially right at the start with the scarecrows coming out of the background, your hair whip is fairly underpowered. So you have to sit there and whack away at enemies. And a lot of times what they'll do is you'll stand there and whack away at one enemy that comes out of the background at you. And then an enemy will come out of the background to exactly the spot where you're at and hit you while you're fighting the other enemy, which can get frustrating because they just do that over and over again. So it's kind of this sort of juggling act between, you know, do I want to sit here and fight these enemies that they throw up against me and kind of get hit cheaply? Or do I want to just try and sprint through this entire area and just completely circumvent probably what I'm supposed to be doing in it?
The game is definitely cheap with enemy placement. I've found places where just if you jump, actually, like, you'll be on a ledge, and if you jump down, an enemy will, like, pop out underneath you while you're in midair, and you don't have a time to react and get away from it, which is pretty much how I feel about, like, Ghosts and Goblins and Super Ghouls and Ghosts. So, not a great feeling, and you don't double jump in this game, at least not yet. I think maybe you get something like that later on, because there seems to be a lot of, like, if you go to the subscreen when you pause, there's a lot of places for powers or items or dances or
there's also a lot of hearts that are up on a ledge that you just can't quite get to.
Right, which, hey, man, I'm, like, that stuff makes me salivate. I'm all about it, but, like, I definitely get almost like a, I don't know, it's probably unfair to compare this to, like, the original Metroid. I mean, it is that difficult in the early goings. Like, it definitely has a sense of, like, it's a 2D game, and yet I'm getting lost. I really don't know what to do or what to where to go next. I don't have a real, like, there's plenty of story, but I don't actually have much direction. Yeah. And you know, and the enemies are just really challenging to get past, but I do think it's a lot cheaper than Metroid in the way that they throw enemies underneath you and they have things kind of pop out and jump at you, and it feels like you don't really have a chance to react to it sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, I think my initial impression is that there are a lot of little things in this game that either they overlooked or they decided to do for the sake of presentation. It seems like you know, this is a very technologically advanced
Game Boy Color game.
It's very really beautiful. But I feel like, you know, the attack with your hair, there's like a, like maybe like a half second or a quarter second delay between when you push it and when you actually do the attack because of the animation.
Mm-hmm. And it also has really short range.
Yeah, yep. Compared with the DSi game, it seems like it's shorter range. Yeah.
Where do I get the hair extensions? Because I would love to, like, it, you know, it feels much shorter than, for instance, a Castlevania whip attack.
Yeah.
It feels like you have to be much closer to the enemies to hurt them, which puts you in danger, and it makes you play really aggressively if you actually want to try to kill the enemies, which makes me want to just avoid them.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Well, you also stop completely if you're on the ground and you whip. You're just like, run, it's stop. Run. It's kind of a weird, again, going back to that pacing comment, John.
Yeah, I mean, they also have the...
The aimless... Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, they also have the day-night sort of mechanic where the enemies seem to be a lot tougher at night than they are during the day.
Yeah. Yeah. Castlevania 2.
Yeah.
So, for those who aren't aware, you can actually talk to the people in the villages, and they actually do provide some hints. I don't know if you realize that, because John, you mentioned, I didn't know whether to go left or right, but I think one of the townspeople tells you what's left and what's right.
Okay.
So there are some hints in there, but I definitely ran into stuff both outside the dungeon and inside the dungeon so far that I'm like, I got really far. It was tough to get there. And then, oh shit, there's a door with a key and I got to go back all this way. I just feel like it kind of punishes you for exploring more than some of the later Zelda or Metroid games do. You know, they're better at like having the key door up front and saying, okay, you got to go somewhere else first.
Yeah.
And it just feels like there's a lot of places in this game where you can go pretty far the wrong way and not get anything out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if this is one of those games that becomes way more fun as you get deeper into it, you know, as your character has more abilities at your disposal and you feel like you have more, maybe more mobility or just more endurance to get through these areas, and you start to have a better sense of how the different areas connect to each other, because that definitely is part of it. You know, I wonder if it's one of those games that's just really difficult at the beginning and then it gets easier and or just more fun as you go through it.
Yeah, that's just it. I feel really underpowered right at the beginning. I mean, that was one of the things. I mean, you start collecting the gems or rubies or whatever they are. And I, you know, I came across the shop and I was like, oh, I hope one of the things that I can buy is something to give me more hearts so I actually have a chance against these enemies. But that's not the case. You just, it's like, have a potion. Okay, well, a potion doesn't really help me. Well, first off, I can't afford it. You know, because I'm trying to avoid enemies, and the enemies are what drop the rubies or whatever they are. So that's kind of at odds, you know. It's like you would think that you should want to kill more enemies and enjoy killing enemies so that you get more of the currency, but you actually try to avoid enemies so you don't get currency so you can't buy potions. So it kind of, you know, it kind of creates a vicious cycle that you get caught in. So you kind of have to farm, I think, is what you kind of wind up doing.
Did everyone play the DSiWare game?
I
no,
did.
I didn't.
Because I'm kind of surprised at how similar these two games are. Maybe I shouldn't be, but there was like a lot of like, oh, wow, that's, yeah, that was repurposed in the DSi game, and that was repurposed in the DSi game.
Like, I'm recognizing environments.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean,
they look different because on the DSi game, they're, you know, way higher resolution, and there are a lot more frames of animation, but they're, it's definitely set in the same world, and you can recognize some of the same characters and some of the same areas that you go through and even some of the same monsters.
Wow. But you don't get the three planes of death, right?
Gosh, was that in
was
the
that
DSi
in
game?
DSi?
I don't remember that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I mean, the DSiWare game did not light up my world or anything, but I enjoyed it. I think it's a very flawed, you know, Metroid-style 2D platformer. And I have some of the same problems with that game that I'm having so far with the original. But I enjoyed it overall, and that's why, and I was curious enough, like this game, the original Shantae, I think is like $300 or $400 if you try to buy a cartridge of it, because it's super rare.
Probably like 1,000 units of the actual original run.
Yeah.
Jeez. Something absurdly small.
Right. It's very rare. It was like a really late, I think it came out in like 2002 or something like that. So it was a really late Game Boy Color game, and it's very small print run. It was published by Capcom, although somewhat begrudgingly, I think. And they've never wanted to reprint it or do anything with it. So the reason this game is finally out on Virtual Console is that WayForward basically, I think, pretty much bought the rights back from Capcom and sort of released it on their own. Like, you still get that Capcom logo in the beginning because that's part of the game. It's coded in. Mm-hmm. But I think WayForward pretty much self-published this on Virtual Console. And good for them. Like, that, it's awesome that this is available. You know, I think it's a very interesting game for sure. And I would recommend that people check it out, especially for what, $5 or whatever it costs.
It's worth
$5. You know,
absolutely, it's worth $5.
Jump in. It is gorgeous. Like, technologically, for Game Boy Color game, it was probably the best looking Game Boy Color game I've ever seen. It looks amazing. The music's really good. It controls great. I'm just, like, a lot of WayForward games, I feel like it's very ambitious and it's very pretty, but the execution is maybe not quite there. Like, I don't want to judge it prematurely, but I get the same feeling from it that I do a lot of WayForward games, which is that they try something really interesting, and I'm just not sure they have the design chops to completely pull it off.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm definitely going to be playing more of it, for sure. It seems like a pretty beefy game, also.
Yeah, I feel like I just have to punch through the initial part of it and kind of, you know, kind of get my feet under me before I start tackling these other areas. So
right.
Yeah, my hope is that, like, once you start unlocking some of the other forms and buying some of the attack upgrades, I noticed in that second town you can buy a bunch of, like, attacks,
mm-hmm.
which look like, you know, maybe those will be more effective or have
except
a different
range. Super expensive.
Yeah. So you're right. Yep. I mean, I think that as more gets unlocked, I fully expect this game to become more enjoyable.
Yeah, I mean, I usually feel the same way about Mega Man games, but the difference is, and we talked about this when we did Mega Man 3 for Retroactive, like in Mega Man, it's obscenely difficult at the beginning, but you have all these choices of where to go, and so you can kind of look for a weak point or find a stage that just suits your playing ability a little bit better. And then once you break through, you start to pick up a little momentum, and then you get one power, and then you get two powers, and before you know it, it all kind of falls out down like dominoes. And I feel like this is a different kind of game, you know, because the world is interconnected and there's some more RPG elements and stuff. But I remember feeling the same way about Risky's Revenge, the Shantae game on DSiWare, in that I remember being pretty frustrated with it in the beginning, felt that it was extremely slow. But definitely once you get new powers, you start to open up new areas and it gets to be more fun. But I mean, like, you compare it to another, you know, somewhat Metroidvania style game that came out earlier this year, like Guacamelee. I think it's night and day, the difference in design ability between these two games. Because Guacamelee is immediately fun. You know exactly what to do. And you feel empowered right from the very beginning. And then as the game goes on, it just becomes more and more fun. And these layers start to open up that kind of blow your mind. There's all this stuff that was there from the very beginning that you just didn't understand. and it becomes easier but also more interesting to play as it goes forward. And Shantae, it's a slow burn at the start for sure. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I've been playing for, you know, a couple hours really, and I feel like I really have barely scratched the surface of what's going on here, and I feel like I don't really feel like I know what I'm doing yet, but I'm going to keep pushing forward.
Has anyone else had trouble telling difference between background and foreground in this game? I feel like I've like tried to jump on something that I thought was a ledge and I just fall through it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's a little bit, yeah. Yeah, they don't really do a good job of having the ledges kind of pop out at you.
Yeah, that may be hardware limitations or just, you know, trying to put in, you know, like wanting things to look good artistically, but maybe not giving enough credence to, you know, making them practical.
Yeah.
Cause I've had the same thing, and there's a feeling of maybe a little bit of trial and error in terms of figuring out which platforms are solid and which ones are not.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to what Mike has been playing this week.
Yeah. So, it's a game that I think has been discussed a lot already on our podcast, but, I've been playing Darksiders 1 on my PlayStation 3. It's a game that I never picked up when it came out. You know, I remember like Neil raving about it at the time, but I just wasn't mm-hmm. feeling the love for it.
Greg and, really liked it too.
Yeah.
I think when Greg played it, that was the turning point for me where I was like, I should check this out.
Yeah. So, you know, I think the sequel came up fairly recently on Radio Trivia when Zach was on and asked me, you know, I haven't played either of these games. I'm kind of curious, which one should I try? And he's like, you know what? You should try the original one because that one's really like a Zelda game. And if you like Zelda games, you're going to like this game. And, well, he was right. I mean, I think it's a really good game, maybe in spite of some of the art direction that I don't really like. But I guess that's to be expected from a Nintendo gamer. But I mean, the game's a lot of fun.
It's very much like, it's been compared to World of Warcraft, but I think some comic book artists, some known comic book artists did the design for the creatures, right?
Yeah, Joe Madeira, I think.
Right. So that's his style, just like big beefy dudes, looking scary and cartoony.
Yeah, right. Big beefy dudes, kind of dark colors, lots of kind of gross looking textures. Not like intentionally grossy, not like, you know, like blurry. Mm-hmm. But the actual game design is really good. I mean, there's some real weird quirks with the game. Like, you can see some of the seams, like with the cutscenes. Like, you'll be on your horse, and all of a sudden the cutscene will start, and you won't be on your horse. Or all of a sudden, you know, you go into like the you know you defeat a boss in a dungeon, and you walk into like the aura, and then all of a sudden you're just sort of walking outside the dungeon. It doesn't like show you transporting or anything. It just like all of a sudden, okay, cut to like 20 minutes later. Just I don't know, just there's some things of the presentation that feel kind of rushed or fragmented, maybe.
Yeah, not well planned.
Yeah, I have to think there were different teams and they didn't, you know, some of that just happens. But you know, I feel like the level designs and especially the dungeons get better as the game goes on. The combat, I'm not sure what to think about the combat, even after finishing the game. I think the actual combat mechanics are actually pretty decent, but I think there are just too many kill rooms or something. I'm not sure what it is, but I got frustrated at times with some of these, you know, places where you had to battle, even though they're pretty generous with the respawn points.
They're very front-loaded, though. I feel like once you get about halfway through the game, you almost never have to do that anymore. Or if you do, it's over much quicker.
Right. I mean, there's certainly rooms in the dungeons where it's like, okay, now I got to fight a bunch of guys. And sometimes those go on for longer. But the first two main areas, I guess they're trying to train you how to do the battle mechanics. And so like they put you in these really annoying rooms that might last for like 5 minutes where you're supposed to kill them all within 5 minutes or survive for 5 minutes. Or it just feels very forced and ugh, you know? But especially like the last couple of dungeons, man, they just get really clever. I guess at this point, there's no point in spoiling. You don't have to worry about spoilers. There's like a dungeon where they use the portal gun, basically, and and that's a lot of fun, even though it's a little more restricted than, you know, in Portal.
It's a lot more restricted. Like, you can only put portals on certain kinds of surfaces.
Yeah.
But it's still, the stuff they have you do is really clever.
Yeah.
And there's very little combat. I mean, that thing has no purpose in combat, so it's all about platforming and puzzle mm-hmm. solving. And those sections of the game are challenging, but they're also so satisfying, and they're not really interrupted very much by combat, because it has nothing to do with that.
Yeah. So, you know, this game's really good. If you haven't played it, if you have a way to play this game, check it out. I mean, it's not perfect. It's got blemishes. But, I mean, man, you know, good on THQ for this. I mean, I'm sorry it didn't work out for them. But, you know, it sold a lot, but I think their budget was just so huge on that game.
I rented it closer to when it was released, and I didn't really take to it, but I think that has a lot to do with the fact that 3D Zelda games don't really do it for me. And so a lot of the things that bug me about Zelda games just bug me here.
Oh, yeah.
Like the traveling seemed to be taking forever. I don't know if the environments were too big or the character too slow, but I felt like there was something off there. So
It gets better because you get the horse later on.
Yeah, I think that I stopped playing just before the horse. I was in some desert and there's giant worms.
That is, in fact, right before the horse.
Yeah, but that section just annoyed me so much. That's where I just stopped.
Yeah.
And it was a rental.
It's part of the reason in Darksiders 2 they give you the horse. I mean, because you are one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, right? Mm-hmm. So in Darksiders 2, they give you the horse from the very, very beginning of the game. Because also the world is a lot bigger, and there's some teleportation places, and that also, I feel like the the warp points in Darksiders 1 take a while to get to.
Yeah.
But they are very useful later on in the game. There's a lot of stuff like that. Like, I remember when I first played it, I didn't understand the, cause I rented it from Gamefly, I think it was, and played the first couple hours, and I got stuck on that boss, the first big dragon boss, Tiamat, which is pretty hard.
I think I was like the hardest boss in the game.
Yeah. And it's very early in the game, and I got stuck on that, and I ended up sending the game back, and it was a lot longer. It came out real cheap on digital download. I just downloaded the game and picked up from my save file right where I left off and got through that, and then I enjoyed the game way, way better after that. But Lava also has to do with the fact that it really doesn't turn into 3D Zelda until past that point. Before that, it feels much more like a God of War or Devil May Cry style just kind of combat game. It's just all about kind of moving from room to room, killing the dudes, and then you move on. And the real Zelda style dungeons and items and puzzles and just really interesting kind of explorative adventure gameplay, it takes a while to get to that part. And once you did, I was all about it, you know. Especially seeing Zelda through this weird lens of a totally different cultural perspective and a different style. You know, the whole comic book style is so different. And it's all, you know, very much rated M. And there's just a lot of stuff in the game that would never, ever happen in a Zelda game. So it ends up being very much a Zelda game in structure, but not at all in style. And it's just so interesting to see those two things mash together.
Yeah.
It's a good ass game. That series is probably going to continue, by the way. There's a company, I forget the name of it, but they picked up the rights to it in the THQ auction. And I heard an interview on the Giant Bomb Interview Dump Truck podcast where they were talking with the guy. Patrick was interviewing the guy at E3 who his company bought the rights. And he's like saying, you know, basically like the guys who made the game are a little bit scattered right now, but we're hoping to, you know, basically they got the rights, the company owns it, and they're interested in pursuing it, but they need to find some backing. So they kind of need someone to put together a concept, and then they get the financial backing to actually develop it, a new game, which is going to be a big price tag. And then they have to kind of assemble the team who's actually going to do it. But basically they have some kind of long-term plans to do that. So hopefully there will be a Darksiders 3 at some point. I still need to finish the second one, but I just have to get back to it.
Cool. Well, that's all I had for Darksiders.
Cool. All right, Guillaume, what have you been playing?
I was I'm still playing Shin Megami Tensei 4, but since I wasn't really ready yet to talk about it again, I decided to download Attack of the Friday Monsters, A Tokyo Tale, since I had heard that it was very short, so I wanted to play through something really quickly. Mm-hmm. And I'm just a fan of the guild games by Level 5 in general. So, and I was definitely on board as soon as I heard the basically the idea behind Attack of the Friday Monsters, which is basically it's like 70s Tokyo suburb. You're a kid who's living in a small town who where every Friday there are giant monsters that appear. Like, sign me up for that. But yeah, like, so the idea is very interesting. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of an adventure game, but perhaps more a visual novel, because there's really not, there's no puzzles in the game. There's no, you're basically just following what they tell you, where they tell you to go on a map. You talk to different people. You're this kid, this transfer student who knows that there's, you know, like something weird going on in this town. And with your friends, you're trying to find out where the monsters come from. So yeah, you just talk to people. The adults also seem to know that something is going on, but everything, you know, like the from the trailers, it looked like the basically visually the story would always concentrate on this little kid and not on the giant monsters. Like, it's all from his point of view physically. Like, you've got these towering giants over him and things like that. But it's also true that it's from his point of view in terms of how the story is told, because there's a lot of things that he, like, he's a fourth grader. There's a lot of things that he and his friends misinterpret, but us as adults, we know that something else is going on.
Oh, that's so, a form of irony, isn't it? When the audience knows something that the characters don't.
Dramatic irony, irony. I believe.
Yeah.
Dramatic irony. And, you know, you'll see them just, there's like this little girl who says that she gets her self-esteem through good doing good deeds. And another kid asks, what's self-esteem? And she says, I think it's, you're inflated with steam when you do good things. And, you know, or they'll get something wrong. Like, they hear about the concept of reverberation. And then from then on, the main character keeps saying, like, reverberation, to other kids. And it does a lot of clever things like that. And even though you know more than the main character, the story still manages, like, as soon as you think, oh, okay, I know what's going on, it does throw a couple of wrinkles here and there, and it ends up being completely crazy. And I was very satisfied with that aspect of the game. Like, the setting, the story, how it unfolds, it's all really, really, like, I think the game really managed to do what it set out to do. The trouble is, I think it also managed to do what it set out to do in terms of gameplay. It's just that the gameplay is very unambitious. There's basically nothing to it. Like, I would have wished perhaps for the game to be more, to have more of an exploration element. And you can explore basically all of this little town, but anytime that you need to go someplace, it's going to be marked on your map. And so there's not really any purpose to exploring more. It's just like, well, okay, I might as well not waste my time and just go directly here. As I said, there's no puzzles. The only kind of gameplay there is that you can beat other kids at this card game. And sometimes it's required through the story that you beat a kid at this card game so that he'll give you information that you need to move on in the story. And the card game is very simplistic. It's just a rock, paper, scissors thing. And there's some luck involved, some strategy. It's not complicated at all. But yeah, like, so I wish that there were something more there. I wish that I had to actually not just, you know, discover the story as it evolved, but more that I had to piece things together a little bit more. I don't know, like, throw in some sort of puzzles in there.
So just to be clear, this is a game with giant monsters attacking your village, but you don't get to fight the monsters. You're just one of the villagers.
Exactly. And the monsters really only show up towards the end of the game. Like, the game takes place over the course of one Friday. And so, like, during the whole, like, the first three quarters of the game, you're just seeing, like, the evidence left by these monsters. Basically, you see their giant footsteps in the road. You see, you know, and you talk to people and they talk about how these monsters come out on Fridays. But you really don't see anything until the very last act. It's trying to evoke like an adventure that a kid has on a summer day, you know. Sure, it's in Tokyo, so it's not exactly, you know, something that we can absolutely relate to, but it's, you know, like the sound design is really good. You've got the cicadas chirping always in the background. Mm. The music is fantastic. It's very, very cinematic. There's
it sounds kind of like a Japanese version of Super 8.
Perhaps a little bit. Perhaps they were kind of trying to go for the same thing, except that Super 8 is scarier in general. There's not really a horror element to Attack of the Friday Monsters.
Oh, it's a cute monster.
Yeah, you could say that. But yeah, like just overall, like I feel like this would have been better suited as some sort of animated movie. And it looks like it's kind of trying to be one without being one. I suppose that just making this downloadable game is just so much cheaper than actually making a feature film that's 2 hours long. But it's, you know, the pre-rendered backgrounds are very pretty and very cinematic, as I said. And, even like the opening starts with, opening credits and a song sung by some Japanese woman. And it's funny because, you know, you don't understand the lyrics, but they're subtitled, and the lyrics were written by the director of the game, and they're the most literal lyrics that you've ever seen in a game. It's just like, oh, I'm a little kid, I'm in fourth grade, my dad is a dry cleaner, my mom is not very impressed by him, and so on and so on. Like, it's just, at some point I thought, like, this has to be intentionally funny. Like, there's no way you can make, you know, lyrics this literal and not trying to be, like, I don't know, cute or something. So, yeah, like, I am really glad that I got to play it. I'm really glad that I got to enjoy the story and that this goofy thing is out there. But it's hard to recommend as a game. I think that you have to feel like seeing some sort of anime in order to really get into it.
It really does sound like a visual novel.
Yeah.
Like a Japanese visual novel.
Yeah. Yeah, as I said, like, it's, I don't know, like, I don't regret paying for it. I'm glad it exists. It kind of made me hungry for perhaps, like, one of the other games that this guy directed that never made it out of Japan. Like, he makes a series called, like, My Summer Vacation, where it's basically... Oh,
yeah, okay. I've heard of that.
Yeah, like, you might have heard about it on 8-4 Play. They were interviewing, they had Ray Barnholt on there, who did an interview with this guy. And so he explains what these games are about, and it sounds very interesting. It's just you're trying to, you know, have the most fun out of your summer. And, yeah, you go explore, you make friends, you, I don't know, it sounds intriguing. And perhaps you get a little bit, a little taste of that in this game, but there's not really any exploration. So I feel, I don't know, I would have wanted more out of it.
Yeah, it sounds almost like, at least that the other series you're talking about, the Summer Vacation series, it made me think of like Animal Crossing without the chores and with a lot more nostalgia.
Yeah, yeah, oh, definitely. It's all about nostalgia, about the feeling of being a kid.
Cool. Anything else, Guillaume?
I've also been, I just moved in with my girlfriend, so I don't have the television as much to myself as much as I used to, but I have been watching her play some of my games. She, you know, like, she already played a lot of Mario, she likes Kirby, she likes the Lego games, but recently she started up Zelda A Link to the Past, and...
Very nice.
Hmm?
Very nice.
Yeah, it's the, you know, like, she was saying, it's exactly what I like in a game, just like an adventure and solving puzzles and fighting. Like, she finds it very fun, and she asked me, is this game well regarded? And, you know, I'm just like,
yeah,
how do you answer that? Like, oh, well, it's only just like regularly on the list of, you know, the top games of all time. Sure. Yeah. It's pretty good. It's considered pretty, pretty good. So yeah, like it's really interesting to experience this game through her, through someone who hasn't been playing games for the last 30 years. Because I realized just how much I've been trained to understand video game logic, and someone who's new to that will not have the same instincts and will not perhaps like notice the same things. For instance, like the cracked walls that you're supposed to bomb. I feel like every time she enters a room and then she leaves, I'm just like, you know, I'm just,
yep.
At some point I made the mistake of commenting like, like, this game is all about observation. You need to be more observant. And now I'm getting some comments about, oh, I guess I'm not observant enough. So I sometimes I feel like I should have kept my mouth shut.
I'm taking notes.
But yeah, like, she enjoys it. But also, like, the It's also like I find that I have to fight my own urges to sometimes help out a little bit too much. You know, like I don't want to be solving these puzzles for her. Like it's, I've played this game before. It's just, but at the same time, I have to resist the urge to sometimes grab the controller and perhaps like help out with a boss. Yeah. Like I just like, it's very interesting. Like I realized just how tasks that you don't really think twice about anymore because you've done them so many times, such as fighting that, what's it called? That snake boss.
Oh my god, at the top of the tower?
Yeah.
I was about to bring that up.
Yeah.
That thing is fucking crazy hard. Even now, when I go back and play through Link to the Past every few years, as I am wont to do, I almost always fall down a couple of times because that guy just knocks me right off. It's so like, hard.
In Link's Awakening, you don't fall down, but you do fight it. I think it's the first boss or maybe the second boss. So I feel like I, you know, like I don't think twice about it anymore when I'm fighting him. But geez, like seeing that boss just throw her back down one level in the tower again and again and again. It's just so frustrating. And that's really like what I'm trying to juggle here. Like I don't want the game to frustrate her too much, but at the same time, I want to let her have this experience of overcoming this huge obstacle by herself. Right. So,
And that's the last thing between you and the Master Sword.
It is. No, right now she's actually in the Dark World and she's facing the Elmazor King. She got to him without me in the room, you know, like she does, you know, she can figure her way around a dungeon. But she says that she tried using the hammer on his helmet and that it didn't work. And I'm like, are you sure? I think maybe you... I don't know, like, maybe you should try again.
Yeah, you have to be really close.
Yeah, yeah, and that's the thing, like, not only is she not familiar with Zelda games in general, but she also is less familiar with a four-button controller than with a two-button one. I mean, like, she used to have a Genesis back when she was a kid, and mostly she's been gaming on the Wii with, like, a sideways remote. So now it's just, like, every time that she needs to... use the sword on a wall to try to like knock it to see if there's a weak point somewhere to bomb a wall. She's always trying all of the other buttons first. You know, like they're still not in her muscle memory.
Yeah. Well, even on Genesis controller, a lot of those games, from my recollection, a lot of times in Genesis games, you'd have two buttons that did the same thing.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times they'd be like arcade ports, and a lot of arcade games only had two buttons, which is the reason the NES controller only had two buttons. Mm-hmm. But Genesis was like, oh, we're going to be better. We're going to add a third one. But then in a lot of Genesis games, a lot of games didn't really use all three buttons, especially Sonic, which didn't even use two buttons.
But yeah, like I just find how, like just watching how difficult it is to figure out the... kind of the transition between the light world and the dark world, how that's going to change the shape of the land and how that's going to open up new paths. And seeing her like get killed by enemies, like that's not something I feel that happens very much anymore. And yeah, see, like I understand a little bit better, perhaps like the decisions that Nintendo has made with Zelda games, you know, as the years went by. Up until Wind Waker, where enemies just take out a quarter of your heart and combat is not a challenge at all. Like now, I now realize that they've been observing people like her, people less that haven't been trained on Zelda for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And that basically informs their design now.
But it sounds like she's doing really well.
Yeah, yeah, no, she is. And it's just a matter of, I think that as kids, we had infinite patience because we had limited games and we had unlimited time, and that's just not true of adults. So it's she will go to an FAQ sometimes, and you know,
like, yeah, but so did we. I mean, we had Nintendo Power and we had friends who you know,
or sometimes the game just sat there on the shelf until maybe you picked up a magazine one day and found the answer that you were looking for.
Happened to me.
Mylon Secret Castle.
I think I was stuck at a place on Zelda, the original Zelda Second Quest, for like 2 years, and then I finally found where that dungeon was, because the dungeons are really well hidden.
Yeah, but I think the second quest in Zelda, the first one, is something else. That's a whole nother level.
Oh yeah, I understand it, but I think I mentioned it on this podcast, but I had kind of a similar experience to you, Guillaume, with my wife. although she's not as experienced a gamer as your girlfriend, it sounds like. And so, you know, I was like, yeah, why don't you try this game? You know, it's fun. It's exploration, you know, and she really liked the idea, but she just couldn't get over the combat. She couldn't get used to the pacing of the combat and, you know, how long it takes to swing your sword and stuff like that. So she really couldn't get into the game. So I'm glad to hear that, your girlfriend was able to get over that hump.
Yeah, I feel like perhaps something like, you know, I do want her to experience the games that I love. I think that perhaps stuff like Super Metroid is a little bit too complicated with like three buttons that you have to press simultaneously.
But yeah, that's a hard game too.
Yeah, but I'm hoping that perhaps like we can go get through like Secret of Mana and Earthbound. I think you can play two players during battles.
Oh, really?
That's what someone told me.
That's very cool. I never knew that. I know you can with stuff like Final Fantasy VI. You can play two-player in battles, which is a weird feature that no one ever uses. But like it would be good for, you know, playing with a significant other like that. And I think JRPGs are actually a really good direction. If you live with someone who has a lot of trouble with the reaction speed for a game like, you know, Zelda or Metroid, go with it. Try a JRPG because it will have a lot of the same qualities that they might be interested in, but you can take your time and make decisions and you don't have to have really good reactions. And through that, you might over time get more comfortable with the controller, get more comfortable with, you know, reacting quickly just because through sheer repetition and the amount of time that you spend with the game. And that might be a launching pad to get into more demanding games, you know, in a dexterity sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's very exciting. I'm looking forward to, playing more games. And it's just cool to see Link's Awakening again, Link to the Past again. I was kind of planning on playing through it myself before the upcoming Link Between Worlds. But now I think I find that just spectating this playthrough is enough. And it makes me more hyped for the 3DS game that's coming out.
Yeah, I can't wait for that. Just on the subject of Earthbound, I've actually been thinking about maybe trying to show that to my girlfriend because I haven't started playing it yet. I downloaded it the day it came out, but I haven't started playing it yet because I haven't had time. And I'm kind of thinking like, I bet she'd be really into it because it's a familiar enough setting, but it's also so weird and funny and charming. Mm-hmm. And it seems like maybe the perfect game to sort of rope someone in who's not all that well versed in video games, certainly has never played that kind of game. But there's something, especially with the setting, you know, with it being this strange version of America and with all these familiar elements like ATMs and baseball bats, and there's cars in the game. Like, how many JRPGs have cars?
Right.
You know, so I feel like Earthbound is maybe like the perfect entry point for someone who's never played a JRPG, but might be interested in a funny story, cute characters, and gameplay that, you know, doesn't rush you so much. You know, it doesn't require you to be really, really, really skilled in terms of your hand-eye coordination. So we'll see how that goes. I may lose that argument, but I think I might try to make the case. But speaking of JRPGs that have cars, my new business is going to wrap up the segment because I am getting very close to finishing Ni No Kuni. And it's been a long time coming. I got it back when it first came out in February, I think. And it's just been...
You got it like 2 days before I visited you last time, I think.
That's right, because I was showing you like really early parts of it. Yeah, I think I was in the first dungeon when you were there and I was showing you that stuff. Well, you know, obviously I haven't been playing consistently since then. It's just a game that like... The pacing is not always that great. So sometimes you go through a section where it just seems brutally difficult and you have to grind like crazy to get past. Some of the bosses are just amazingly difficult in this game. I'm really astounded that they weren't rebalanced for the American, or for the Western version, because I think it is in Europe as well. But it is so beautiful. It is such a great game. I mean, it's just the world they've created just begs to be explored, and the characters are so charming and interesting. And I'll say that the setting of the game and the backstory of all the stuff that's going on in the game, they do a good job of sort of foreshadowing it early on. They show you these mysterious scenes where this council of people who are kind of dressed up like like the bad guys in Stargate, you know, they have these kind of weird Egyptian helmets and white robes. They're all sitting around, and there's this white witch character with a creepy talking parrot, and they're all discussing the fate of the world and what they're going to do about your character. But you don't know who these people are. Why are they talking about you? Where did they come from? What do they want? What is your role in the, and like, I'm now over 40 hours into the game, and I'm just barely starting to figure that stuff out. I mean, it takes so long, but there's just so much richness in the story. There's so much going on, and they definitely unfold it very gradually. But I don't know. The longer I play, the more I appreciate that. Actually, there are really interesting elements here that sometimes the true nature of characters, when it's finally revealed, it's more impactful because you've spent so much time with that character that you just can't believe there's something that significant that you haven't yet learned about them. I felt a little bit like that in another level 5 game, Dragon Quest VIII, where you learn about 80 hours into the game that your main character is actually a dragon and that your little mouse friend is actually like your mentor or something like that. It's like, how did you hide this for so long? It's like, it seems insane that they would do that, but also it really is more impactful. Because this character who you thought was just a voiceless, nameless cipher, he's just your dude, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm still talking about Dragon Quest VIII, but like, you go through the entire game, and then finally in the epilogue, after you've beaten the main boss of the game and completed the story, this epilogue section, they totally upend all of your expectations and everything that you know about the character. And there's some, you know, Ni No Kuni echoes that in some really interesting ways. So, it is a long game, and John, I think you probably made the right decision to not pick it up on that deep discount, because it is a long ass game, and it's no cakewalk either. It's really, truly difficult. As much as it looks like a children's cartoon, and it does look very much like a real Studio Ghibli movie. It's just a brutal game. I mean, it's really difficult, but very satisfying when you get past a tough boss. And you know, maybe not surprisingly, but I do feel like as I get deeper into the game, it's getting easier now. Maybe I just understand the systems better, but I think also I'm kind of, the characters are rebalancing a little bit. My main guy is getting so powerful that I don't really have to use the sort of Pokemon familiars anymore, and I can just stick to Oliver and cast his magic, which is very powerful. So, you know, I think the game does kind of have this hump in the middle where it is more difficult. Sometimes it's a little harder to get through because you kind of see the trajectory of where the story is going, and you just kind of are waiting to get through it. But then I reached this kind of breakthrough point. I beat this guy who they've been talking about the whole game. And now it seems like maybe the game's over, but then what about all this other stuff that was never resolved? Oh yeah, now that's coming into play, and there's a whole other section of the game, and at this point, I really truly don't know what's going to happen. And that's exciting, and it's surprising for that to happen so late in the game. But I'm still very much enjoying Ni No Kuni. I think there's just nothing like this being made. Like, the closest thing would be some of the Tales games. I think Tales of Xillia is about to come out. You know, Vesperia and Tales of the Abyss and stuff like that. I mean, they're definitely of a similar scope, but they're not done nearly as well as this. The production values are not there in the Tales series. And I just don't think they're as pretty. I don't think they're as creative in terms of the stories that they set up. And Ni No Kuni is just, it's a stellar production. I mean, it's just an incredible cartoon game. And I say it again, I will never get tired of how awesome the game looks, because the art style is so astonishing and it's executed so well. The game is just a dream. Like, I've had lots of people come over and just watch me play it. You know, people who know nothing about it, they come in, I'm already 30 hours into the game, and a friend happens to walk in the door while I'm playing it, and I'm like, oh yeah, let me just get to a save point. And they just sit there mesmerized because it looks so amazing.
Yeah. I mean, very,
it's a wonderful game.
Yeah, it's not very often you actually feel, you know, like you actually are playing a cartoon. You know what I mean? Like, you actually are playing anime.
Yeah. So, to me, this game is kind of like a Wind Waker. Like, this game will still look good in 10 years, regardless of what new technologies come along, because it's just, the artwork is so great. And it's so beautiful and charming. And, you know, Earthbound is the same way. Like, that Earthbound's almost 20 years old, and I still think it looks awesome. I always thought that it looked great because it looks so different from everything else back on Super Nintendo. And it totally holds up.
That's what draws me to Ni No Kuni, is the fact that I know that it's so unique and there's nothing else out there that's really like it. So I really want to experience it.
Yeah. And as much as you like Pokemon and John, I can pretty much guarantee that you'll enjoy it. I just don't know when you'll ever get around to playing much of it. That's the thing. Like, it is a slow burn. It takes a long time to really get going. And a lot of the best and most interesting mechanics in terms of how you play, the things you can do in combat, the ability to capture monsters and train them. A lot of that stuff doesn't come in until very late. Even like simple things like getting multiple characters in your party. It takes many hours to get to that point. And, not to say nothing of like things like getting a ship and being able to explore the world at your leisure. That stuff takes a very long time to roll out. But when it does, it feels like a huge, significant event because it totally changes the way that you connect with the game and all the things that you can do. Mm-hmm. But it's a pretty awesome world to be in, and I'm going to be sad when it's over, although I'm also going to be very happy when it's over because it's been like my number one must-finish game for months. So I'm excited to finish it and play other things. But I will be sad when it's over because it's a delightful experience. So that's Ni No Kuni. It's only on PlayStation 3, unfortunately, in the West. The DS version will probably never come over, but it's worth seeking out if you have a system you can play it on. All right, so we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we've got your listener mail. Back, everyone. It is time for listener mail. We love hearing from everybody, and we've got quite a few emails in our backlog. We're going to see how many of them we can get through here. I think some of these will be shorter, and I don't never want to make any promises because I've seen us spend an hour on one email before, but I don't think that will happen with these at least. Anyway, the address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and I hope you will be inspired by one of these to send in your own email for next time. And John is going to read the first one.
Well, Johnny, this one's certainly inspiring to me from one of my favorite fans of the show. His name is Suckit James Jones, and Suckit James Jones writes, with Earthbound finally being released on the Wii U Virtual Console, I think it's pretty obvious that Mother 3 will now be in the works for a North American release. What do you think?
John, do you think it's ironic that you just read your own email?
Perhaps I planned it that way, Johnny.
This is your ghost account, right?
No, it's actually not. I don't know who wrote this.
Well, specifically, James asked for people to he said, "Oh, and now I'm going to get emails and like do bring your emails telling me to suck it." So
and James may have written it.
We got them and the tweets too and the comments. Yeah.
Yeah. I do think if we're actually going to answer this question, I personally do think it's a possibility. I think it was one of my predictions or at least I was hopeful. It's not out of the realm of possibility. Like Nintendo is being weird lately, like releasing Earthbound and having strange deals with Atlas and who knows what's going on.
I would argue it was weird that they never released Earthbound a long time ago.
Right.
On the Wii Virtual Console. But they're caving in. I do think they're learning and, for what it's worth on the Miiverse community, you know, the game's only been out a week and there were already like 16,000 people on the Miiverse community, which makes it one of, probably easily one of the most popular virtual console communities on Miiverse. Mm-hmm. And I expect that, you know, as the word of mouth goes around that, hey, this game is out, it's affordable, it's awesome. I mean, Scott Thompson just wrote a fantastic review for IGN as a freelancer. Where he reviewed Earthbound and he gave it a 9 out of 10, and there were 1,000 comments on his review first day.
Yep. Yeah.
People are interested in this game, including a lot of people who've never played it.
Well, it's funny because, you know, it seems logical that you would give people what they're asking for, but sometimes with Nintendo, they just don't do that. Mm. I mean, I've never thought that Nintendo actually mined its back catalog enough.
No, not
and,
even.
And,
it,
and, you know, I mean, we've talked about this, how we think, you know, they should turn VC into some sort of subscription kind of thing. You know, it's like, I just feel like there's so much money to be made there because people sincerely love these games. Love them. Even more so than when they first came out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, it just takes a while for Nintendo to seemingly get that idea that people will actually buy. It seems like there's a gulf between what Nintendo thinks will actually happen and then what would actually happen. Like, they just, they have, it's like they have it set in their mind of what the demand for this product will be based on something that was thought up 10 years ago or something. Yeah. I don't know.
Now, with Earthbound being $10, do you guys think that's just because they can?
I wouldn't be surprised if there's some sort of royalties for, you know, some of this questionable stuff that I've heard over the years.
Right. That's what I wonder is if they're paying some license fees to some intellectual property holders, especially in the music of the game, and maybe that's why they're charging a little bit extra. Kind of like, you know, like when Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles first came out on Wii Virtual Console and it was $6 instead of $5.
Yeah.
It's like, well, we got to pay the company that makes Ninja Turtles to let them so we can re-release this game, and so it costs us more to do it. So we're going to pass it on to you, but it's still $6, you know, and that's the thing about Earthbound. Like, it's more expensive than other Super Nintendo games, but compared to buying the cartridge, geez, it's still a ridiculous bargain. And you can play it on your gamepad and et cetera.
I think that's really just what happened. Nintendo probably said, you know, been for a long time saying, yeah, we can't release it because Super Nintendo games are $8 and we're going to have to pay these royalties based on some settlement that no one knows about.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're just not going to do it out of principle, or we don't think people will buy it. But then at some point, they probably rethought that. You know what? People probably will pay a few more bucks for this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course they will.
And they did it.
And I think that people would be a bit less cynical about it if perhaps, because there is variable pricing on the 3DS eShop for virtual console. Some Game Boy games cost less than others when they're simpler. Yep. So it would have been nice, perhaps it would have gone better if the early SNES games on the Wii U Virtual Console, like Pilot Wings, had been like $7 or $6, then there would be more of a feeling that the there is a scale here, depending on how big the game is or how advanced the game is.
I have to wonder too, how much of a wake up call Operation Rainfall was for them in terms of seeing how passionate their fan base is around these games, and if people say that they want a game that will actually translate into sales,
right?
Mm-hmm. You know,
I hope so.
Like they've been crediting the release of Earthbound entirely on the fact that people were asking for it on the Japanese Miiverse. You know,
Japanese Miiverse.
Well, yeah. Well, Americans were going to the Earthbound page on the Japanese Miiverse and were saying, "Release this in America."
I guess I could see that because Japan only looks at things in Japan. Maybe like NCL mm-hmm. only looks at things that are going on in Japan. I mean, you think of all the other stuff, like the whatever Starman.net,
right?
You know, petitions and stuff that were probably submitted to NOA,
right?
And, maybe those just went into the bit bucket. I don't know.
but perhaps there is some sort of shift going on at Nintendo, because also it's a coincidence. But today, Nintendo of America's Twitter account was tweeting a link to a survey they're doing about their presence on social media.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to go give your opinion on that, there's the link is probably easy to find. And, they're asking for our opinions. So,
do
like,
I get Club Nintendo coins if I do it?
No.
Johnny, you coin whore.
I need that platinum. Again.
Well, I don't know if it really answered the question, though. I mean, I think
Guillaume did.
Ultimately, I don't expect Mother 3 to get a North American release because there isn't an English translation already out there that's official.
Yeah.
And I doubt that Nintendo's going to go and, like, repurpose a... you know, a fan translation. So it's, you know, you got to do like a ROM hack to translate.
You're right. There is a very technical aspect.
Is that a case even with like GBA games?
It's probably easier to do because the character limits aren't as strict as they were back on Super Nintendo.
Right. But, and they must have like changed the way they did things. No, like there must be some sort of separate file that they can edit.
I mean, the fact that a bunch of fans on the internet did it for Mother 3.
Yeah.
like probably tells you that it is easier to do on a technical level than some older games were. But I think, the biggest problem against this, like, this is totally doable. Like, if someone at NOA decided, or even back in Japan, if somebody said, hey, there's this market for Mother 3 in America, we should spend $50,000 or $100,000, whatever it costs, to get someone to localize it. Maybe just pay one person who knows the game really well already, and just, you know, give them 6 months to do it or a year to do it even. It's already old game, so it doesn't really matter how long it takes. And just, you know, pay them to do it, and then we'll just dump it out there and see what happens. They could probably make money on it, but the problem to me is that even among people who are interested in Earthbound and who might end up buying it, I feel like a very tiny fraction of those people know about Mother 3. Again, Mother 3 is very obscure. It is kind of a famous game on the internet, but famous is very relative here, right? So Earthbound is a game whose popularity and the interest in Earthbound built up over more than 15 years on the internet, in part because some people were actually playing it. And if you really wanted a copy, you could go out and buy it, and, you know, a 5-year-old could play that game. That's not really the case with Mother 3. It's much more complicated to, you know, apply an English patch, if you even know that such a thing exists. And, you know, it doesn't even have the same title.
Well, series, so I know you're going to go there. I'm sure that if they're localizing it and putting it, they could probably rename it for North America to say Earthbound 2 or something like that. I still don't see Nintendo going back and reworking this title unless they're like remaking it for the Japanese audience too. I just don't see them putting the GBA ROM out there.
I agree.
I think what's most likely is that they've started working on a new Earthbound game, and they're thinking they're going to release it internationally.
And that's Earthbound 64, of course.
Yeah, right, Earthbound 64 too.
They should totally call it that.
Wow.
They'll call it Earthbound Onet Stories or something like that. You know, the Return of Ness. Something like
I agree with TYP somewhat in that it's if it was a no effort sort of thing, I think that there would be a chance of them doing it. But the fact that they would have to go back and significantly rework it, and probably also, you know, I mean, if they wanted to make the money back out of it, they would have to market it. So,
yep,
you know, and just since it's only coming out on VC, it would just be kind of, I don't know. I just can't see it happening. There's a lot against it.
I'd love for it to happen.
The only thing going forward is like they did that for, Sin and Punishment, right? I mean, that was in English sort of, but they did have to change some of the text, right?
Yeah. Basically on the menu. They translated the menu.
So, I mean, there's some precedent for that, even with the first part of the game.
But I just think for Earthbound, though, they would probably have to do... There would probably be a lot more effort than Sin and Punishment in making it, you know, how Nintendo is very... They're into making things culturally acceptable.
Yeah.
You know, they always tend to rewrite stuff like this, especially things that are very Japanese, like the Earthbound series is. They would, you know, try to do their best. They're not going to do a half-assed job at it, really, is what I'm saying.
I guess if I'm a WADA in this case, to go to an email we had last time, I'm looking at this saying, well, it's going to cost more to release Mother 3 in America than it did Earthbound on Virtual Console, because now we have to pay someone to localize it, and we have to do more marketing for it to let people know that it exists, and it's probably going to sell fewer copies than Earthbound. Because it's not a legendary game. You know, it's not going for $300 on eBay. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have this giant clamoring that Earthbound... It has a fan base, and it has some people begging for it to come out, but not nearly as many as Earthbound. Like, most people in America don't have fond memories of Mother 3, you know, the way that they do about Earthbound. So, I think you're looking at selling fewer copies for a game that costs a lot more to release. That... is hard to justify, unless Earthbound is just so popular on Virtual Console that they can say, well, if we only sell half as many copies as Mother 3, then it's still worth doing, because half of a million is half a million, and that's great, but Earthbound's not going to sell a million copies. So I don't know what the magic number is, but I just, I'm not going to rule it out by any means. I mean, at this point, you know, when they've re-released Earthbound miraculously, and, you know, in a world where they did do crazy stuff like Sin and Punishment on Virtual Console, I don't want to rule out anything, because I think Nintendo is proving to be somewhat unpredictable in a wonderful way lately. I just don't have a great feeling about it. I don't think it's as cut and dry. I don't think it's an obvious thing for them to do. But, you know, fingers crossed, man. All right, well, let's move on to the next email, guys. And TYP is going to read that one.
All righty. Well, Matthew writes, "It seems like to me the only reason the Wii U tablet was made was because Wii U tablet was made was because tablets are hot right now, especially the iPad, and Nintendo thought they could cash in or were worried that the iPad would take away from their casual audience. What do you think?"
We've talked about this before, right?
Probably a long time ago, like, you know.
I don't know. You hold a Wii U tablet, you hold a Wii U gamepad in your hands, and I don't think there's... I never came away with the impression that I had been using a tablet.
Doesn't feel like an iPad.
Yeah, no. I think it more extends their whole dual screen, you know, principle more than anything. I think they're trying to do that. I think they're trying to bring that to the console space more than they are trying to just copy the iPad.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand that the presence of a touch screen is, you know, means it's going to be similar in some way to the iPad in that it has a touch screen. But I feel like before the iPad came out, there was some, you know, like you did end up seeing some mock-ups of, you know, weird Nintendo controllers, right? Made by fans where a screen was there. I feel like it's always been some sort of logical evolution of controllers.
Sure, we'll go back to Dreamcast with the VMU.
Yeah.
You know, I had a little tiny black and white pixel screen embedded in the controller. Wasn't used for very much, but it was very limited technology, but it was really cool. And it's not that hard to think of, you know, of course that was also removable, so it's kind of portable. It had somewhat different use case, but it was still interesting and they could show customizable information on the VMU screen while you played the game. I mean, so it's not a brand new idea. It's just Nintendo did it better than anybody else has done it in the console space.
Mm-hmm. Well, Nintendo certainly has never marketed the Wii U gamepad as like, yeah, you can do this instead of what you do on your iPad.
No, they should, though.
They've never done it, so that makes me think that wasn't their driving rationale, right? Yeah. They pitch it as asynchronous multiplayer or off-screen play, but they haven't said like you can use this as your tablet for whatever writing down notes and stuff. I mean, they never pitched it like that.
Yeah,
you know? Like, look, this is a powerful internet browsing device. They never really they never pitched it like that. You know,
when your marketing plan includes the word asynchronous, maybe take a step back and try again.
If you're explaining, you're losing.
Yeah, you know, if you have to spell it for people in the commercial, that may not be the best slogan or theme. But yeah, I like the fact is, kids love playing games on tablets. Like, I see it everywhere, and they're playing shitty games. You know,
amen,
like,
brother.
To me, it should be really easy to convince them to play these much better Nintendo games on this other tablet. But that's not really how it's being sold. And I mean, it is a very different kind of device. You know, you do have to be at home to use it. But I do think it's interesting that Nintendo hasn't done a lot of, you know, they haven't really shown, much less released, very many games that are sort of played in the same kind of form factor where you just kind of, you hold it maybe vertically, maybe horizontally, but you just kind of use your finger and you play the whole game that way. And it's, you know, very easy to jump into and you play it for a few minutes and then you have to share it with your brother or sister or whatever. I see that stuff all the time, like at the doctor's office, at the grocery store, at restaurants, you know, like I'm getting to the point where, you know, I go to a restaurant and I see this like 12-year-old there with his grandparents and they're eating breakfast and they're trying to have a conversation with him. And all he wants to sit there and do is stare at his iPad and play Cut the Rope or something. And I just want to go over and shake him and say, damn it, kid, spend time with your family.
Exactly. I totally agree.
Sorry, I'm getting old. But people love this stuff, and tablets are so expensive, you know, but that they're all over the place. Like, my mom got a Kindle Fire HD, and the main thing she uses it for is to let my niece, her granddaughter, play little things on it, you know? And, you know, my niece is 3 years old. She doesn't care if it's a good game or not. But as she gets older, she will care, I hope, if I do my job right, she will care. And there certainly are good games on the iPad, but there's way better games, I think, on something like a Wii U. So I'd love for that to be some kind of transition for her. But Now, I don't know. Nintendo's not really making it easy for me right now, because it does feel like a completely different kind of product. And I feel like there is probably a way to bridge it, but I don't know. They don't seem to be going after that. So I don't think it's as crass as Matthew makes it seem like. Maybe Nintendo just looked at tablets and said, you know, that's really interesting technology. How can we do our version of it and put our games on it and not alienate the people who, you know, who already like us and what we do?
Yeah, I just feel like the Wii U gamepad would have happened regardless of the existence of the of tablets. Because there's just too much. It was just pointing that way with the DS having a touchscreen.
Yeah.
And with the Wii having motion, it just ends up making sense. You know, you combine the two, you get the Wii U gamepad.
Fair point. Okay, well, let's move on. Guillaume, why don't you read the next email?
Sure. Cody, a.k.a. F-Zero Boyo, writes, what do you think would have happened if Nintendo had chosen to launch the Wii U in 2013 as opposed to 2012? There's the obvious gap in software and possibility of going up against two other platforms, but perhaps it would have been it would have given more time to flesh out the product from when it first arrives in the hands of the consumer. Thanks once again for delivering a top-notch show week in and week out.
I wish they had released it in 2011 instead of 2012.
Yeah, probably would have made more sense.
Even earlier.
Yeah,
the Wii was not in very good shape in 2012.
Wasn't in good shape in 2011, dude. That would have been the time to do to make your transition. Yeah. That's my point.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I still don't quite fully grasp how things fizzled so much on in terms of the Wii lineup, and yet it didn't look like they had actually been working on games for launch for Wii U. Or if they did, there was some serious upending of tea tables going on or some shit. Because
apparently
in time, like Nintendo just sort of like, I don't know if they laid off everyone or gave them all like long term sabbaticals. It just feels like there was like a whole
it's like yeah, like what was actually happening?
Right.
Yeah. Know? Like I mean, I feel like this crappy transition period where Nintendo has to learn how to make HD games and stuff like that, and has to learn how to take advantage of their new hardware. This would have happened regardless. Like this is a difficult transition to make. We saw a lot of companies struggle with it back in 2006. And it's not even that surprising to me that Nintendo would fall prey to it. I just wish it would have happened back when, you know, when they could have afforded to do it, you know, back when there wasn't that much going on anyway, back when the Wii was still, you know, kind of a little bit successful, and there were at least still a few games coming out for it back in 2011, and they would have been so far ahead of the competition that everybody would have said, hey, like, I don't completely understand this, and it looks like Nintendo doesn't either, but it's the only thing interesting going on right now with hardware, so let's check it out. But the problem is, like, they waited till 2012 to release it, and by that point, everybody's, like, looking at their watch saying, when the hell does the new PlayStation and Xbox come out?
Yeah.
And now a lot of people have basically just said, I'll pass. You know, the Wii U, it's interesting, it's kinda cool, but it's not cool enough for me to choose it over the alternatives, and at this point, they've given up their head start, they've done so little with the head start, that they've given the competition time to show what they're doing, and they've given all the publishers time to decide it's not worth it, you know, and it's put them in a bad situation. So I think they should have gone even earlier, not later.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Wii U will do okay in the long run, because I think that a lot of people are still, just because of the timing with PS4 and Xbox One coming out, I think a lot of people are like, oh, well, now I'll just buy an Xbox One or a PS4, and I'll get Wii U a little bit later when the games start really coming out for it. So I think over time, I think it'll be okay. I don't think it's going to, you know, completely dry up or anything, because I think a lot of people still like Nintendo games, and a lot of people are keeping an eye on it, but that's the thing. But Nintendo just didn't seize that. You're absolutely right. You know, they just let it slip through their fingers.
John, once again, the Wii Nintendo's console becomes the console to play Nintendo games on, and that, you know, and so okay, it doesn't really matter if this thing's underpowered compared to the others or not, because it doesn't really affect how much Nintendo really does with developing their games, because they feel it's powerful enough for what they want to do anyway. It's, you know, the underpowered nature of it's really more of an impact for third parties than Nintendo itself, really.
Yep. Yeah, true. And for anybody that who's going to buy the console, I mean, they probably aren't going to stack the Wii U up against PS4 or Xbox One anyways. Yeah, just like same thing with the Wii, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. At this point, you know what you're getting into. Like, yep. It's apples and oranges, right?
Yep.
So, I mean, just like on Wii, you remember the Wii 60 campaign where people were saying, well, like, the best gaming combination is to have a Wii and an Xbox 360, and then you can play virtually everything that you would ever want to play, and there's almost no overlap. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if Nintendo's lucky, there will be a similar sentiment this time. They're not there yet. But, you know, if it ends up being like, you know, PS4 and Wii U ends up becoming sort of the gamer's choice for a combination of platforms, then that bodes very well for them because, you know, the problem is right now, like, they don't even have the unique stuff that people want to play in the first place. So mm-hmm. no one's arguing for a combination because people don't even think you should buy it in the first place right now. So they've got a lot of work to do to get to that point.
The other problem they have is the fact that it's still $350.
Yeah.
And PS4 is going to be $400. So people are, right. So say somebody buys an Xbox One and they're like, well, you know, I'd also like to get some other console. And they look between, you know, they better like Nintendo games.
it's not even necessarily the comparison between Wii U and the other platforms. It's just the total. Like if you are thinking, well, there's no way I can game on just a Wii U. It needs to be that plus something else. Yep. Well, that combination becomes a lot more viable if the total is a lot less. So yeah, it's just $750 to own a Wii U and PS4. That's a hard to swallow combination for people right now. And it won't always be that way. But I think the quicker they can bring down their production costs and lower the price, the better, because then you open up a lot of possibilities for people to say, well, maybe this will be my second console that I'll play certain games on it.
Yep.
Cool. All right. Well, I will read the next email. This one's not really a question. It's more of an edumacation for me in particular, I think. So Ibrahim writes, with regard to the discussion about the cost of the Fire Emblem and Shin Megami Tensei promotion on Nintendo, I would like to clarify a few things. Although digital goods do not incur the same costs usually associated with traditional business practices, it still follows the same principles. When a company sells a digital product, that does not mean that every dollar in revenue is a dollar earned. The upkeep for the servers, the maintenance, royalties, and software licensing all fall under the operating costs or costs of goods sold. As for the treatment of the $30 in electronic store credit and its cost on the company, traditional accounting principles would apply too. The company would have to consider this store credit an expense and deduct it from further revenue. So whether the games purchased from the eShop are Nintendo's or not, they would record the revenue, then subtract the store credit. I personally didn't completely follow all of that because I'm terrible at economics and business stuff. Which is funny because I talk about it way too much on this podcast, but, Ibrahim sounds like he knows what he's talking about. So I'm going to trust him on that and say, mea culpa. I was probably talking out of my ass when we were talking about that $30 eShop credit.
So yeah. So basically what he's saying is that they are actually technically losing that $30 as revenue.
They're gaining so much though. There's always the possibility that people will not spend the entire $30 credit. There's always the possibility that people will buy way more stuff, that some people will discover the eShop for the first time.
Sure.
I mean, I don't think that $30 is that big of an expense for them for the things that they have to gain.
Nope.
And you know, like they've got, like Shin Megami Tensei 4 has so much DLC right now and it will only keep coming out. And, Fire Emblem had DLC as well. So they've kind of tied that credit to the right games if they want to see it spent all in one place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, they've also got like this is like the prime, moment for them to give this credit since they've got so much, coming out in the next few months on both 3DS and Wii U. So yeah, I'm not sure if I followed the entire explanation myself, but somehow I think Nintendo will be doing well with like will be okay with mm-hmm. this.
Oh yeah, I mean it amounts to a loss leader, really.
Right, right. A loss leader, just like a Black Friday sale. It's like get people in the door, that, you know, give them something free. They'll buy a bunch more stuff. And overall, you'll make a ton of money on them. And especially with something like the eShop, where if you get them in the habit of coming in and they keep coming back to look for new things and keep buying new things, that $30 will, you know, is to use an economic term, that will be amortized very quickly if you can get people to be repeat customers. Mm-hmm. So I still think it sounds like a really, really good promotion for Nintendo, not just for consumers.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, mm-hmm. it trains their customer base to get in the habit of buying these games online.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and they're doing another experiment right now. I don't know if you guys have seen this, but this week, if it's probably going to be over or almost over by the time mm-hmm. the podcast comes out. But if you put...
You have like 1 day left.
Yeah, if you put $50 or $100 of credit on your eShop account, on the July 28th, they're going to give you $5 or $10 in additional eShop credit.
Yeah, I feel like a sucker. I bit on that one.
I feel like
a sucker just because I haven't bought a whole lot of stuff on my Wii U on the eShop.
No, but you will. That's
I will eventually. I will definitely buy full price retail games eventually. Mm-hmm. And when I do that, I may as well buy them on the eShop. I prefer that in those situations. So I know eventually I will spend it. And it's like, well, you know, 10% return on investment in a naive way. I mean, that's how they want you to think about it. Mm-hmm. It's pretty good. So, you know, I went to Best Buy, I bought two $50 gift cards, and so it's whatever. Well, I think there was a post and talk back that basically said what I did too, mm-hmm. which is like, yeah. Well, I get 4% cash back through the rewards program, and, you know, there's the digital premium thing I'm a part of still for getting the deluxe Wii U, and you know, you can rationalize that shit, you know.
Yeah, you'll get the 10% digital deluxe back when you actually download a game with it,
right?
So that'll come later, but you will get that on top of the mm-hmm. you know, $10 back that you're getting from the special promotion. So yeah. I'm gonna use it. Hell yeah. I got Pikmin 3 coming up, and then probably either Wonderful 101 or Rayman Legends not too long after that. So I'll use that $100 very quickly on the eShop. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, speaking of our comments, on the news story, someone commented, oh, like, this is a desperate move. But I don't really, like, they just want to line up their coffers for their investors or something. But
yeah, yeah.
I really don't think that's the case. I mean, it's not as if it's the end of the fiscal year. Far from it. And yeah. So there's no reason to do that now. The real reason would be that if you have people put credit on their eShop right now, it's going to be easier to push them to buy something with it later. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so much easier.
Right. They're committed to buying something.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's going to be so much easier to push people to buy the Pikmin 3 on the eShop if they've already got $55 in credit on there.
Right. You know? Well, I think it's very significant that the, you know, I mean, the tiers of money here are $50 and $100. These are big dollar amounts. So if you take advantage of this, you're going to have so much money in your eShop wallet that you will be more prone to buy big things on it, because they really want you to buy things like Pikmin 3, especially first party games. Mm-hmm. They really want you to buy that stuff digitally versus retail, because they make more money that way. I mean, I know, you know, Ibrahim was saying that, you know, there's still costs associated with, you know, with them selling you games digitally. I never said there weren't. I just think the costs are way less. Stuff like licensing and royalties and, you know, getting ESRB ratings and stuff like, they have to spend that money either way. But the cost to maintain servers, it has to be a tiny fraction of what they give retailers for distribution and what shipping costs to ship stuff out to stores and out to people's homes.
It's more of like an upfront cost, you know, the incremental cost for adding another game to the eShop and hosting that is pretty minimal compared to having to ship shit to retailers across the country for like every single game you'll sell.
Yeah, so I think it's very important that this is not just 10% of whatever amount you put in there, because then you could put in $5 and you get one back, or, you know, you get 50 cents back. You say, okay, well, then I'll use that to buy Nano Assault when it goes on sale or something like that. No. They want you to buy retail games. And that's why these amounts are as big as they are. And it's probably going to work, you know, and especially on Wii U, where people are not nearly as concerned about an account system on Wii U because it's not a portable system. So you're not going to lose the system. That was my big problem with 3DS, right? When I lost the system, it's like, well, now all my games are gone with it. So that's when I had to go get a friggin' police report and crap like that. My Wii U will never move out from underneath my TV. Nothing's gonna happen to it. So I feel way more secure about having digital games and full price, very expensive, $50-$60 digital games. I'm happy to have that stuff stored on the Wii U because that Wii U's not going anywhere. Nothing bad's gonna happen to it. I mean, unless it gets struck by lightning. You know, or whatever, but
that would kind of suck.
You know,
your whole system
happens.
Gets fried.
Red Ring of Death.
Yeah.
Yeah. True.
All right. So let's go back around to John for the next email.
All right. Clifford writes, since Nintendo has blundered the first year of Wii U with the biggest drought in Nintendo's history, why is it this company has decided to hold no one responsible?
Ooh.
Is it time to say goodbye to Miyamoto? I know it sounds like blasphemy, but he's the head of game development, and from what I've read, he really doesn't have much to do with actually developing games. I've read he gives suggestions to developers via email between award shows. From all the promoting he does for Nintendo, it feels like he's a mascot who isn't invested in the company anymore. This company feels like it's run like the Willy Wonka chocolate factory instead of a business with little interest in making money given the fact that that the biggest market in the world, I'm assuming he's meaning the West, North America, is an afterthought. Companies like Apple and Microsoft part ways with their business people all the time, and they're the most successful companies in the world. Is Nintendo as a company so bankrupt in humility that they feel that they have nothing to learn from the West? Do you see anything that could make this company change outside of Yamauchi dying?
All right. First off, Nintendo is a pretty traditional Japanese company, and the Japanese companies tend to not lay off people. Really.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, I know they have, you know, things have changed some now. And I think when we were talking about that Project Sora, you know, the thing came up about how, like, you know, sometimes these sort of, I don't know what you would call them, virtual businesses or whatever. I mean, they're a real entity, but they're really not intended to be a everlasting thing. It's just sort of a company developed for one project so that they can disband the company and people lose their job and no one is really fired.
Yeah.
And in Japanese culture, especially these big companies, there isn't a lot of laying people off. There
doesn't really Ken Kutaragi still work for Sony?
Probably. I think he left, didn't he?
Japanese employees might leave if they've been shamed and they'll go to another company. That's different from being laid off.
Gunpei Yokoi did that.
Right. So, I mean, first off, this isn't just a Nintendo thing. It's a Japanese culture thing. So is the focus on Japanese market as a Japanese company. I mean,
sure.
They don't know how to think, you know. I don't know. Just to some extent, they don't know. Mm-hmm. They don't know what they don't know, you know. They're not listening to NOA. They're not listening to the folks in other areas of the world. They just tend to do what they want to do.
You know, and on the subject of like, will Nintendo ever learn? I think they are. You know, I think you the fact that we're talking about like promotions on an eShop where you can download full retail games to your system. This is something that it's hard to imagine 5 years ago that Nintendo would ever do it. I mean, we talked about this stuff for years on this podcast, just kind of hopelessly, and now they're doing it. They did it very slowly. I mean, they're going to do it at the Nintendo pace. You know, they're going to take tiny little steps. They're going to screw it up, and then they'll fix it, and then they'll do it slightly better. It's just like with these firmware updates on Wii U. It's like the system's kind of a mess at first, but little by little, it gets better and better and better, and it happens over time so that you may not even realize just how much better things have gotten because it didn't happen overnight. You know, but you compare this stuff back to the way things used to be. Like, do you remember when they released NES games on Game Boy Advance cartridges and sold them for $25-$30 a piece?
Mm-hmm.
That was stupid. But they learned from that there is a demand for their old games on new platforms. And now we have 3DS Virtual Console where you can download that stuff for $3.
Yeah,
they do learn.
Yeah, but they're in their own little world sometimes. I think the thing is, and by their own choice. I mean, I think they kind of I feel like they kind of cultivate this air of being outside of the industry or not outside the industry, but rather being unaffected by the industry. Like, you'll hear them often say, we don't really care what Sony is doing. We're doing our thing, right? Regardless of whether or not Sony is, you know, beating them or doing better than them or has done something wildly innovative, Nintendo is really unconcerned.
Well, you want that to some extent, though. You don't want them to be copycatting other people. Like, you'd right. like True. For them to be selective.
But
like,
that can go too far, though.
Yeah, but it's a tough balance to learn from mm-hmm. others and still maintain your own unique identity. And True. Some people can pull it off and some people can't.
Yep. And how much do we place the responsibility for Nintendo's failures on Miyamoto? Because I think none. That's yeah. not really...
I think he's none. The wrong yeah. person to... If you were complaining about the like certain aspects of certain games being too similar, or that might be a Miyamoto influence, but the fact mm-hmm. that their project management seems like it's in the shitter right now, that's not Miyamoto's fault.
You know,
there are individual directors that are managing these different projects.
Yeah, I think you could probably make a case. I'm not sure I would agree with it, but you could probably make the case that Miyamoto is a much better game developer, director, and creative person than he is a manager. Mm-hmm. And maybe since he is at least in title, he is in charge of managing Nintendo's internal game development. The fact that they, for instance, can't get their shit together on the Wii U launch and they end up delaying most of their games for the first year. Maybe that is on his head to some extent, because maybe he didn't understand the resources they would need, or maybe he shuffled people around in an incorrect way and it caused things to get out of hand. But that's a localized problem. I don't think it's like a decade long thing. And he's been doing yeah. that job for about a decade. So I think if anything, you might want to blame the people on the board, which we know very little about, you know, what goes on with the board. Yamauchi is still on the board, even though he's retired from being the president and CEO. But I think you might want to, you know, blame people like the board and maybe like Iwata for putting too much on Miyamoto, for depending on him too much, and not for not spreading out some of the creative authority and some of the managerial decisions among other people. I think Miyamoto works his ass off. I think the stuff about him shooting emails between award ceremonies is fucking ludicrous. I don't know where you heard that, but they're full of shit.
I mean, I think a lot of the stuff, I mean, with Nintendo in general, having a hard time with HD development and all that. I don't know how much of that you can really put on Miyamoto, because I feel like that's kind of more of a technical direction sort of thing. Like, there should be somebody under him that just owns that, you know?
Yeah.
It wouldn't necessarily mm-hmm. be him. It would be somebody else whose job is to set up the technical vision of the company. I mean, he's more of a game design guy. Like, you know, he sets up sort of these are the kinds of games we are going to make. How we're going to do it, that's somebody else's job to figure that out.
You're right. Like, so, you could probably blame him for the portfolio. Like, if you don't think there's true. Enough variety in the games they're releasing right. or something yeah. like that, that probably is a lot on Miyamoto.
Yeah, like, you could blame him for them not having a Halo-style first-person shooter, right?
Sure.
That's his choice, to not add that to their overall game portfolio. But all that other stuff is, you know, like that, like TYP said, how they manage their projects and how they set games up. That's all. That's project management, technical direction stuff. I mean, that is, mm-hmm. we need these many people. This is what we need to do. That's entirely different from what Miyamoto does. So
yeah, I mean that's all Microsoft project type.
Yep, bean counting kind of stuff.
You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's not even just Nintendo. Like, I think, you know, we haven't said much about it, but like the fact that Wonderful 101 got delayed so much. I mean, that's from a company that has made plenty of HD games. Mm-hmm. You know, Platinum is not Nintendo. That game's being made at Platinum with some level of supervision, but we don't know what from Nintendo. But that's not those guys' first rodeo. So the fact that they're struggling with it too, you know, maybe it's something really weird about the hardware that they've had a hard time coming to terms with. Maybe it's because they're trying to innovate, and they just run into some design things that make, hey, this is harder to make this game than we thought it would be. HD out of the picture, you know, just to do the kind of game that we wanted. We'd never done anything quite like it, and it's tough. Yeah. So, you know, I think there are probably a lot of multiple causes here, and it's probably a mistake to chalk it up to just one or two things.
Hmm. Do you think that Japanese companies overall have not really done a good job of cultivating multiple kind of high-level like developers, like to bring them to roles that like overseeing roles where they could command like larger teams, but I mean have a sufficient number of them? Like I feel like with all the people that have left Squaresoft, there's not really that many people, like with the experience of Miyamoto, that are left there. And same thing with Capcom. I mean, Inafune was basically the last guy to big name to leave, and I don't hear any names that replace him.
Right. You know? Well, and it may just be that you haven't heard of them, but they're there. But I mean, even I would go back to Platinum. I think they've done a good job of having multiple people who are kind of figureheads and who are well known and who have a base of games that they've developed in the past that kind of gives them a certain identity. You know, there's a certain auteur theme at Platinum where, you know, a new Platinum game comes out and someone says, well, who's directing it? Oh, that one's Mikami. Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. Well, I know him and I know the kind of games he's made in the past, and I know I'm either interested or I don't care based mm-hmm. on that. You know, and yeah, maybe for a lot of companies, you only have one guy who's really has that kind of reputation. But I think if you only have the one guy, you're thankful that at least you have the one. Because there's plenty of studios who don't have that at all. And it's very hard for them to have a sort of identity for their games, especially, you know, when you announce them way in advance and you're trying to get the press interested, you're trying to get communities, fan communities to kind of gather around it. It really helps to have at least one personality like that, who you can kind of attach to and say, well, I know that this person has done cool things in the past, you know, from the guys who brought you Scary Movie comes blah, blah, blah.
Oh, like, bad example.
Yeah, but yeah. But that's the thing. Like, that helps those movies sell. Like, that sells tickets, even whether it's good or not. You would like for that to be part of the equation. So
you can at least frame it in terms you understand, right?
So I think what we're going back and forth between is, you know, there's the director and then there's like the executive producer, and there are people that wear those hats in game communities too, right? And it problem might be that like a director on the creative side keeps changing his mind or keeps, you know, saying, oh, I want to improve this, and that causes a schedule shift. Or it could be more of an executive producer saying, well, we didn't manage our people right. Or we didn't you know, have the right budget. And so we've had to do it with fewer people over a longer period of time. And either of those things can cause, you know, schedule delays. And it's really hard to tell what one thing causes it.
It can also cause bad games.
It also can cause, right. If you say, well, I want to stay on schedule. If the people with all the power are the executive producers, they, damn it, this thing's got to go out. Yeah. Then you get a shitty game.
You know, and that, it's really probably a failing of the movie industry comparison that we crutch on so much that I did it just a minute ago. Because the director of a movie is a very different role than the director of a video game. The producer of a movie is very different, you know, and I think in movies, we feel like because it's such an old industry and because it's so popular and so it's so well studied, I think a lot of us, even just casual fans of movies, feel like we understand a lot about what the producer does, and we understand a lot about what the director of cinematography does. But in game development, I don't think even those of us who are really, you know, interested in game development and have followed it and talked about it and read about it a lot, I don't think we really understand very well how those roles are broken down. And there is definitely a wide variety or diversity of what those roles really mean from one studio to the next. Mm-hmm. But like, I remember when we had Corey Lewis on the podcast, this was probably 3 or 4 years ago. You know, Corey used to work in PR at Nintendo. And before that, he was a writer for IGN Nintendo. And then he was a producer, the developer who made that, French Resistance game. Sorry, I can't remember any of the names of anything right now. But anyway, he was a producer on that game. It was the last game that company made. It did not do very well, although the critics really liked it. And he was a producer. And I said, Corey, what does a producer do on a video game? Because I've heard so many people who say, well, I'm a producer, I'm associate producer. What does that even mean? You know, and it's just not clear, and it means something completely different than producing a movie. Right. So,
well, yeah, I mean, effectively, they track dates. Producers plan the project.
They manage schedules a lot. They manage, you know, manpower. They figure out who needs to work on what. But they also are design consultants a lot of times, you know, or art consultants. Yeah. They help choose what, you know, there's a lot of assets being created by your artists and your programmers and your sound people. And the producers end up being, a lot of times, they're the ones who decide what things get put in the game and what things don't. You know, what features get put in the game and which ones don't.
Exactly, depending on how much power they have. Because, I mean, there's certainly some, between the games, between a game director, I mean, the game director, he's the one that would sit there and say, we're going to use this engine. We're going to use the Unreal Engine, or we're going to make our engine in-house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what the game director does. He makes all of those, you know, big choices kind of thing. And then you have design leads who, you know, one guy would be he would design the campaign. One guy would design multiplayer. They would be the leads. And then they would have designers under them. And then above them would be the executive producer who would, you know, maybe a VP or something like that. So, I mean, pretty much everybody reports into like a VP of something at the publisher, and then the producer would be under them, and then he would try to keep everybody on track and ask the director, you know, how are you guys doing? Can you guys hit this date? You know, basically they're cat herders. Producers are really cat herders. They try to keep everybody on time, everything on track. And if something happens in the direction of the game, let's say you outsource something, and that's falling behind, then he has to get on the phone or fly somewhere and get on their asses and get them doing it. I mean, right. production would not be a fun job because
it wouldn't be what I'd want to do on the game.
Yeah. Yeah.
We need those people for sure. All right. Well, let's move on to the next email, and Guillaume is going to read this one.
Dan from Florida writes, I've been listening to the show for about 7 months now and look forward to it every week. I was curious on your thoughts about the Virtual Console. Personally, I think it has great potential, but Nintendo is milking profits on old dusty games that people will pay for simply because they can make money off of them again and spread out the best titles to keep gamers continually interested in it. Part of me thinks that the 3DS took so long to get a good library because Nintendo trying to push digital content and force people to use the eShop, and I almost think the same thing is happening with the Wii U. I really think that GBA titles are long past due on the 3DS eShop, and even though Ambassadors got some exclusive titles, they could still charge for those games if they were to release them to the public. There are so many great GBA titles as well as SNES titles I'd like to see. Games like Donkey Kong Country and the GBA Castlevania titles would be great. I like that the games are preserved as they originally are made, but I would love to see Wi-Fi wireless multiplayer added on as well.
I'm confused by this email a little bit. I don't understand the argument that Nintendo is milking profits by releasing only a few dusty old games and not the ones that people really want. It seems to me like we would all benefit if Nintendo really was trying to milk the service and get more money out of it by just releasing lots more games,
mm-hmm.
And getting people more involved with maybe helping to choose which games come out, and also pushing it in your face a lot more. Like as soon as you turn on the system, it says, hey, dude, Earthbound just came out. You should really buy it. I think they're, you know, not milking it hard enough. And I think we would all be better off if they did, because there'd be more choice.
Yeah, and the whole, like, part of me thinks that the 3DS took so long to get a good library because Nintendo was trying to push digital content. The eShop wasn't even there at first.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, that would have been the perfect time to release, like, really meaty, good VC games. Like, you know, like, we keep harping on Final Fantasy Adventure or Legend to come out, and when is the better time to release a big meaty RPG than at the beginning of a console's life when there's nothing else like it? You know, like you're not going to get the big long RPGs right away, made specifically for that system. So like it would be the perfect opportunity to dig into past titles and to release them then.
Yep. And they're doing that for Earthbound. I mean, maybe they should have done that a few months earlier, but, I mean, it's still, you know, this is still kind of a dry spell. It was only, you know, at the start of when they're starting to release some of their big titles like Pikmin and Wonderful 101. So there's definitely a period of a lull right now, and Earthbound definitely fills a lot of that void.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great time. It's also a good summer game, Earthbound. Yeah. Like it has a kind of a summery vibe to it, and it seems like the kind of game that people would want to play in the summer. To me, it does.
Yeah, I think that the VC takes a long time to get going just because Nintendo is really, really, for some reason, adamant about testing these titles one by one and making sure that everything is right. And I don't know if they would probably benefit from the process being expedited a little bit. At the same time, I wouldn't want to have situations like on Sony with the Final Fantasy V just not really working. You know, like I wouldn't want to be paying for ROMs and then realize like, oh, this is really not a good experience.
Yeah. But there's probably a big middle ground there. I mean, and it's not like every virtual console game ever released works perfectly.
No.
There have been a number that have even had to be patched because they didn't work very well.
Yep.
So I think they do a good job for the most part, but they just, there's not a perfect track record, and whatever method they use to test this stuff is not infallible. But I do kind of wish they would... it seems to me like the people they have doing this stuff, you know, the emulation and the testing and then getting all the licensing, they're doing a good job. I wish they would like clone all of those people and just like build an army, like the Virtual Console Factory, where they have this really good process for getting these games released. And they just need more people to do it so they can release, they just increase the output. Yeah. Like stuff like the GBA Castlevania titles, I am totally on board with that. Those are awesome games. And I think it's crazy that they're not out yet. And there's actually a lot of third party stuff on GBA that's, and Game Boy Color and Game Boy as well, that's very much worth releasing. And I think for Nintendo especially, you know, if these third parties are leaving all the work up to Nintendo because they own the emulation and they pay for the ESRB and stuff like that, then Nintendo is naturally going to favor their own games because they're going to make more money off of those. And so they're much less motivated to do stuff like Final Fantasy Adventure.
Right. I don't know if having a bigger army of people, I don't think more people thrown at this is necessarily the solution. That implies that the bottleneck is in getting these things tested and released. And I think there's probably a lot of more of a political or business oriented reasons why they feel like they want to release them slowly.
Maybe they need more lawyers.
That's what I was just going to say. I totally agree with TYP, is that I think that I just feel like they probably have the perception that in the days of the Wii, they released too much too quickly. And I don't know, because what you saw with the Wii was they released, you know, three games a week for a long period of time, and then they just kind of stopped.
Yeah, but I think I don't know. I understand how you can make that argument, but also think about, you build up this library, and then, I mean, most of the people who will ever own a Wii U don't own one yet. So whenever they do pick up the system, they're going to go to the eShop, and that might be the only time you ever get a chance to sell them games. This happened with my sister and my brother-in-law. They've been on the Wii Shop channel once, and they spent $50. So if your game wasn't on the virtual console that one time they went, it didn't get bought. So I think there's a lot to be said for having this big library, because most people aren't crazy enough to follow what's released on virtual console every single week like we are. Most people just care that it's there when they turn it on. And if it's not, you can't sell it to them. So get it on there as fast as possible.
Lots of games is never a bad thing. I'm never going to argue with you there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm just trying to think of like how they could justify their slow releases. And I feel like they probably feel like they have a business justification.
That's the problem.
For it.
Their only mechanism for promotion is this press release saying, hey, this thing is out.
Well, that's easily solvable, Mike.
If they decouple that promotion from when things were released and just say, hey, we got a sale on these games right now, or don't forget about these games, and they just do advertisements, then it doesn't matter when it was originally released, because they can still, you know, get interest. I mean, that's the same thing that happened with some of these evergreen titles on DS, where, you know, what was it? Like,
New Super Mario Brothers.
10 Dogs that had been out for a long time and wasn't hot, and then all of a sudden they started advertising it around Christmas and it sold like hotcakes.
Sure.
There were a couple of games where that happened.
Yeah. If you haven't played it yet, it's new to you.
That's right.
That's especially the case for Virtual Console. So, I think there's a lot more they could do there, and especially like with stuff like Miiverse and the Wara Wara Plaza, there are so many new ways for people to discover what games are available that I would certainly hope that they're not basing the frequency or the choices in virtual console releases on the fact that they use a press release to announce them.
I get that impression. Maybe that's not the case.
A lot of times, I mean, that press release, a lot of times I can't even find it on their press site, and I have a login. You know, I feel bad for other people who don't have that, because you just have to go to one of the websites that happens to run a story about it, like ours.
I mean, if anything, above all the fans in the world, Nintendo fans would love to if I could get all businessy for a second and brandy, they would love to embrace the Nintendo brand all hours of the day. So it's like, you know, just have it right there on your phone.
Yeah.
Just something. Hey, there's a new game out today. Go buy it. Here's a link or whatever to check it out. Here's a link to a trailer. Just.
If you could like look on your phone and see like a virtual shelf of all your virtual console games and see the boxes for them and everything, and then also see the newest Miiverse postings about all those and tie that stuff in. So like, oh yeah, I should really go home and play that. And oh yeah, these people are telling me about this other game. It has like recommendations and stuff in there. I mean, it's not that hard to think of ways that they can promote this. And make it more successful. And if they did that, maybe they would release more games on it, which is what we all want.
Yeah. I mean, I think it would probably, you know, like you said, it would feed into itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Get the word out. More people buy games.
Well,
make more money off of it.
I will say, I mean, they are improving. Like they're tweeting about Earthbound.
Yeah.
Right.
Cool. You know, like that's new. So.
Yeah. They need to keep improving on social media because I think it was Curve Studios recently that tweeted that Nintendo's stuff doesn't get coverage as wide as the other systems. Like when, you know, like they were basically saying that Fluidity, I suppose, did not get the coverage that it should have gotten. It's really like they need to find that way to get the word out on their digital products. And they really haven't found it. And yeah, tweeting about a game is fine, but
it's
then
the minimal effort.
Yeah, like you've got the PlayStation blog, which, you know, like they actually interact with people. John, you just said that they would want the Nintendo fans to always be, you know, engaged and to always be in touch with them and, you know, buy this product. Mm-hmm. But it really doesn't show in the way that they interact with them.
Yeah.
There's no response when you send comments to Nintendo's Twitter or on their Facebook page.
Well, it's because they're very top down. I mean,
NCL
is at the top. They push stuff down to NOA, and NOA pushes stuff down to the consumers.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It is a consumer oriented business in some ways, but in other ways, it isn't.
Yeah.
And some of their stuff that they used to do that was much more personal and much more direct, like Camp Hyrule, and the whole message board chat room stuff that they did at their website, they shut all that down. Because I guess they didn't see it as being worth the money, or maybe they just were afraid that, you know, somebody on there was going to say something that would look bad and then they would get sued. Who knows?
And I'm sure that they would argue that they're getting the word out through their Nintendo Directs, right? That's probably what their response would be. But that's to a very specific audience that already knows about Nintendo Directs.
Yeah, and that's to an audience that's willing to sit there for 30 minutes and watch a YouTube video about games that are not out yet.
Exactly.
So, yeah. I mean, there is an audience for that, but you'd like to go beyond that also. Like, you have to hit people in multiple ways to get a wide audience. So, anyway, guys, we're going to have to wrap it up there. Thank you so much to everybody who wrote in. We hope that, again, we always hope that other people will think of things to write about. You know, we do talk, I've been thinking about this lately. We talk a lot of industry stuff during listener mail, and clearly people are interested because they keep asking us about it. I would also love to talk more about specific games, or maybe kinds of games. Mix it up a little bit more I'm not opposed to talking about business dealings and, you know, what should they do to save their platform and stuff like that. But we're happy to talk about anything. It's really up to you. You guys decide the topics for listener mail. So if you think of anything that you think might be good, please send it in to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Of course, there's a link on the website. Go to the show notes for the article and you'll find it there as well. And you can get us on Twitter, at least some of us, not you, Mike. But Guillaume, what's your Twitter?
My Twitter is Guillaume NWR.
And John?
Mr. Diamond J, MRDIA, MONDJ.
And I am at Johnny Metz with no H and no Z. And also wanted to remind everybody, by the time this episode comes out, you'll have just a couple days left to vote for Retroactive. So this is your last chance. We will announce the winner on our social media as soon as the poll ends, and we'll also announce it on the next episode of this show. But it will be one of the Wii games, and your choices are, let's see if I can remember them off the top of my head. You've got Prince of Persia Forgotten Sands, which is, the Wii version is unique. Guillaume's talked about it before. You've got Wii Sports Resort. There's Pandora's Tower, which just came out. And, of course, Final Fantasy, The Crystal Chronicles, The Crystal Bearers, which is a very weird Final Fantasy game on Wii that very few people have played. So, all of them, I think, are going to be really interesting for discussion. We'll only play one, so it's up to you to help pick. Please go over there and vote, and let us know what you think of the choices, because, you know, it might help us next time as well. But again, that poll will end on Thursday, August 1st. That sounds right. So get over there before then and make your voice heard, please. We again, there will be a link to that in the show notes as well. And before we go, I wanted to remind everybody that you should be listening to our sister podcasts, the first one being NWR Connectivity. And, you know, this summer they've done a very admirable job of keeping up with the new releases, such as they are. There are games coming out on Wii U, and there are games coming out on 3DS, quite a few on 3DS. And almost every single game that comes out, download or not, they have someone over there on Connectivity who's played it and will tell you about it. So if you're not listening to that show, you're missing out on learning a lot about what's going on with Nintendo right now. And in fact, we also have like some of the very first podcast discussion you'll hear about Pikmin 3, because Don Koopman played the Japanese version. So they're way ahead of the game over there. They're way more current than we are most of the time. And I think you should check it out. And of course, Mike here has his own podcast too.
Well, yes, we have a radio trivia podcast called Radio Trivia Podcast Edition. It's a terrible title, but that's what it is. And you can hear a bunch of people from the various RFN podcasts and others on staff talk about video game music, and you can play along and listen to the music and try to figure out what game it is, and it's a lot of fun.
It's awesome.
I need to work on another episode here. We haven't recorded yet, but I'm hoping to have Guillaume on soon again. So
it's so much
fun. Look forward to that.
It's really fun to do the recording for that show. It's also really fun to listen to. As a person who's done a lot of both.
If you still haven't listened to the recent ones, we had James Jones and Greg Leahy on recently. So
that's right.
Yeah, check those out. They're both very good episodes.
Please do. You can find Connectivity and Radio Trivia on iTunes as well as on our website, NintendoWorldReport.com. Please check it out. Thank you, Mike, so much for being our substitute this week. And we'll see all of you next time right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Later. Bye.
Goodbye.